Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Good Stuff from Growing Up in a Dysfunctional Family, How to Survive and Then Thrive, by Karen Casey. Narrated by Laurel Merlington. Preface. I am thrilled to be writing this preface for one of my favorite books. I call it a favorite because dysfunction is so prevalent in families throughout the world, and I am pleased I was called to write about dysfunction. And as this book reveals in detail, growing up in a dysfunctional family need not doom us for life. In fact, every one of the many men and women I interviewed for this book had grown in immeasurable ways as the result of learning how to survive in their family of origin. And every one of those families might have doomed, forever, each of the people I interviewed. In every case, not only did each person survive, but they were actually inspired to thrive. And that's the real joy of having spent time with each of them. They were living lives of accomplishment and experiencing real joy in the process. Might it have been different? Assuredly, it could have been. But each one of them made lemonade from the influx of lemons life had tossed their way. Is there something that made these interviewees different? I thought long and hard about that, but all I could see was that their survival strengthened them to move forward and go after goals that, at one time, had felt out of reach. Were they somehow unusual? I think not. I think they were determined to be resilient, even in the face of odds that seemed at times overwhelming. They were, again and again, able to forgive the past and grow into the present. They were able to take responsibility for themselves and appreciate kindness wherever they discerned it. And in that act, they too were willing to offer kindness with ease, thus making the journey through life better for themselves and those they encountered. Perhaps one of the most important of all the traits each of these interviewees honed was their willingness to see their own healing and how it was enhanced by connection with others. We simply don't heal in isolation. These many interviewees revealed evidence of that in profound ways. Were these individuals unique? I'd say no. They were simply able to see the good that was often hidden beneath the rubble of their lives, and, in that process, to finally come to see how perfect their journey had been. All along. What a joy it was to meet all these people, and I'm thrilled that you have now chosen to meet each of them too. Your life, like theirs, will experience a profound change. We learn from each other, always. From every person here, I assure you, you will learn something of value. Enjoy your time with each of them. They are so deserving, as are you. Karen Casey, April 2024. Introduction. Over the course of my many decades in recovery rooms, I've interacted with thousands of women and men whose journeys reveal, in detail, the harrowing history of dysfunction that has troubled their lives. Listening to their accounts and being witness to these painful and difficult struggles, I've often been amazed by the speakers themselves at their openness, resilience, sense of humor, courage, and most of all, their eventual and quite triumphant survival, often against extreme odds. For many years, I've been fascinated by the idea that when we grow up in a dysfunctional family, we have access to a host of benefits we otherwise might not be privy to. This is rarely spoken of or written about, I think partly because it seems strange for us to think of abuse and neglect offering any kind of potential value in our lives. But those of us who have grown up in dysfunctional families know that this upbringing has served us with special gifts, and that each challenge comes with new opportunities. The very dysfunction these people lived through taught them sometimes in reacting against it, sometimes in discovering the whys and wherefores of it, survival skills for life beyond dysfunction. They found that there are, in fact, many silver linings, maybe even nuggets of gold. In writing this book, I set out with this assignment, one I'm certain I have been called to do, to interview more than 24 men and women, to listen deeply to their stories and tease out their unique traits and perspectives. Did you know that to interview means simply to see each other? I wanted to see these people clearly and to share with you a detailed description of 12 positive characteristics that are ready to be born in you and then become honed, just as they were in the people from these dysfunctional families. These 12 traits open the door to successful living. The stories I have selected from among the many I heard clearly demonstrate what is really possible when a person not only rises to the occasion to change and grow, but exceeds all expectations in a family that could have doomed him or her to failure. As I observed these journeys, those I saw up close and those, too, from afar, I saw that they were all astounding in one way or another, which might be said, really, about the path each of us takes. I was afforded many aha moments as I noted the specific tools that these people mastered and the positive qualities that they developed along the way. In my conversations, I came to truly appreciate the gifts that we are given, even in those very circumstances that look so bleak to those who watch from outside the family circle. The act of listening is a gift we can always offer another soul sharing our path. My role with those I interviewed was so intimate, really, as they revealed who they were, what happened, and who they are now. In every instance, what had been a downward spiraling life became an example of miraculous survival, offering proof to others that nothing has to defeat us. Through this process, I grew in my appreciation of the importance of both storytelling and being a witness to the story. The exchange moves us, connects us, allowing us to see our own lives with greater clarity, understanding, and openness. We are moved, too, to make some of the changes implemented in the stories of others. We often read and hear the poor me stories of those who are certain they were given a bum ride in this life. All we have to do is turn on daytime television, Dr. Phil, or reality shows for the anecdotes to support this assessment. But I have come to believe, and believe unequivocally, that we choose the ride we are on, one experience after another. We are not victims. We are volunteers. And that knowledge has made all the difference in the world to me. Suffice it to say that many will always live in the world of poor me. That's where they feel most at ease. Without a doubt, they selected this journey, whether they realize it or not, and our observation of their journey surely informs the rest of us in a most interesting way, if we are open to the education. Generally speaking, I think, those sad individuals hope to find others who will commiserate, who will say, "Of course you have every good reason to feel bad. You didn't deserve this set of experiences." And they often do find someone who will commiserate. Misery loves company. Uncomfortably, I admit I used to be that person. Perhaps it was a necessary part of my journey then, but no more. I think we learn from the mistakes as well as the wisdom of others. I have learned from mine along with all of those individuals I interviewed. What I hope to impart in this book is some of both, with an emphasis on the wisdom. In this book, you will hear stories of successful survival, including my own, and you will be offered some specific tools for changing your own stories and cultivating your own gifts, if that's your desire. It was these stories of survival I wanted to tell, stories rife with rich rewards, stories that reveal phenomenal growth, stories that stand as examples to others still trapped in dysfunctional systems. It's my hope that this book will serve as a much-needed resource of hope when the listener doubts his or her capacity to survive within a family that seems destined to create doom and destruction at every turn. My family was dysfunctional, though I didn't know to call it that when I was growing up. I simply knew it didn't feel good to be home. I often felt alone, even in the midst of family gatherings. Virginia Satir, a psychotherapist who wrote many books and helped millions try to make sense of their family of origin, wrote that in the early 70s, 98% of all families were dysfunctional. I can still remember hearing that percentage and reading her book, Self-Esteem. That percentage both astounded me and offered me some relief. Maybe my family wasn't so different from other families after all. I had no idea then that my own life was about to turn a corner. But it did. My search was on for a better sense of self. It was a long search, of course, and it took me down many dark alleys. But I did find the light, and I am here to tell you about it. I think that's the assignment for all of us who have a story, and we all have a story, to share. That's why your journey has intersected with mine, as we meet here in this book. Satir crossed my path through the words of a book, and I took notice. That's what I hope this book does for you. I hope it helps you to take notice of your life, what it was, what it is now, and with some consideration, what it can become. I'm certain that the many characteristics and tools that I'll share throughout this book will make your life more manageable and adaptable to the circumstances you face daily. It's my desire that you will listen to the book with hope ignited, that your own life can be bettered, just as the lives of all of these people were improved because they didn't run, they didn't give up, and they didn't feel shortchanged, at least not for long. They simply lived and looked for the gold hidden within the rubble of their family experiences. No family dynamic, lingering though it may be, has to overwhelm us unendingly. This I promise you. The gold is always there. I promise you. 1. Nourishing resilience. Someone was hurt before you, wronged before you, hungry before you, frightened before you, beaten before you, humiliated before you, raped before you. Yet, someone survived. You can do anything you choose to do. Maya Angelou. In the face of humiliation, rage, degradation, fear of defeat, or simply indefinable fear, being resilient weaves the fabric of eventual success. Rebounding and recovering from the personal insults that life hands us contributes to our eventual growth. Whether these hard times are large or small, overt or covert, physical, mental, or emotional, whether they come from our family of origin, our workplace, or even our circle of friends, these very experiences that could stunt our development instead strengthen it, if we are resilient. Resilience is standing tall rather than hanging our heads and shuffling away when the invitation to give up beckons. Resilience is saying, "Yes, I can," in the presence of those who doubt us. Resilience means never succumbing to the forces of defeat that may be all around us. Few of us graciously accept the insults that so commonly become a natural part of living. That's to be expected, perhaps. But what we manage to tolerate successfully, we will thrive from in time. That's my experience, anyway. And that's the experience I think we can all cultivate. That's the experience I hope to help you develop using the suggestions I offer in this book. Ever since publishing my first book, Each Day, A New Beginning, in 1982, I have become convinced that my calling, so to speak, is to serve as your teacher in any way that I can. By that I mean that I am called to share with you all that I have gathered from others over the years. Through my sharing, I get the added pleasure of relearning all that I offer you. I chose to begin this book with a discussion of resilience because I think it is the kernel that lives at the center of all the positive characteristics we develop when we grow up in families that struggle to be functional. There are countless other strengths that will get our focus in due course, and throughout this book we will discuss how resilience informs all of the experiences we face as we try to make sense of the dysfunctional family system. Resilience serves as a backdrop for lives that move forward, rather than succumbing to the pain and the downdraft of the unenlightened family of origin. I say unenlightened because my research for this book has convinced me that families, for the most part, did the best they could. Their best was simply seldom good enough because it wasn't well informed. And since that was the case, I think it's fair to say it took a Herculean effort by the many individuals who have crossed my path to thrive, regardless of their circumstances. One of the many people I interviewed whose effort to survive was Herculean, for sure, comes instantly to mind. His name has been changed to protect his anonymity. I'll call him William. William grew up in a family extremely short on compassionate attention and very long on his mother's withering criticism, coupled with extended periods of deadly silence. His mother, though not officially diagnosed, was mentally ill, and his father was a withdrawn, silent man, uninvolved and completely distant from his wife and two children. His work consumed him, perhaps as an escape, but nonetheless he was not available for emotional support, guidance, or any expression of love. The family simply didn't function as a unit, but rather like four separate souls sharing the same address. They didn't create a home. Their interactions were few, with the exception of excessive outbursts of criticism from Mom, followed by the nearly immediate disappearance of Dad. My own family resembled William's in some regard. Although there was no mental illness, there was evidence of extreme emotional pain and measurable rage. The punishing silences, coupled with the frequent outbursts by my dad, made the hours at home uncertain, uncomfortable, and unenjoyable. Children like William, and myself too, sought support and a sense of well-being from others. In William's case, he began to excel in school, reading all the books he could lay his hands on, and seeking the approval of his instructors for evidence that he mattered, that he was worthy. William soon excelled at learning how to hide his own feelings of inadequacy. I, on the other hand, rebelled. I met rage with rage. However, I also sought a creative outlet. I began writing stories of happy families and pretending that I was a member of those families. It was a way to lessen the emotional blows, and it proved to prepare me for a later time in my life. The present time, in fact. That's one of the hallmarks of resilience. We grow into the person we are, knowingly or unknowingly, cultivated to become by our family of origin. It doesn't matter, actually, how we get there. It's the becoming that's important. Just as Angelou said in the quote that begins this chapter, the history of pain that pushes us forward needn't be our focus. It's that we pushed forward, we survived, and we agreed to make the journey. I asked a number of my interviewees what resilience meant to them. I got myriad answers, but the crux was the same. Most simply, resilience meant not giving up. But beyond that, it meant making the best of whatever the situation was. It meant searching for the pony in the pile of hay. To Charlie, It meant not giving up on his dream of being an aviator, even in the face of his father's constant criticism. Being told he'd never succeed, in fact, pushed him to prove otherwise. In the end, he not only flew professionally for a major airline, but has built 2 full-scale airplanes since retiring. He was certainly wounded by the criticism heaped on him as a youngster, and even into adulthood. But his dream was never thwarted. The dream was bigger than the criticism. Not everyone is able to rise above without help, however, and that's the reason for a book like this, to help those who are still struggling to put the past to bed by revealing true stories of others who trudged a similar path. People who found a way to move forward with a certainty that was unthinkable in their youth. I found this to be the case for a number of the interviewees, in fact. For Judith, her dad was the bully. The criticism was not only aimed at her, but also at her mother and her younger brother. Judith developed a hard exterior, much like her dad's. However, she was as afraid as he was. Eventually, she came to appreciate the fear that ruled his life. She also observed how his behavior created fear in the lives of her mother and younger brother. The tension in their home was palpable, she said, and nothing seemed to lessen it. A drink or two might relax her dad, but the clenched hands and raised voice were always just a breath or a moment away. Fortunately for Judith, she knew she wanted to teach. She knew she wanted to write. She knew she wanted to help others. The life experiences with a rageful dad and a dispirited mother that might have drowned her actually served as a lifeboat for bringing her story of survival to others. Even though I will share much more about Judith later, let me assure you that she was a good student of human behavior, and watching her parents taught her well about who to be and who not to be. For now, let me simply say that she didn't maintain her hard exterior forever. Even though her father was never able to shed his, she came to understand and to develop compassion for what had initiated his attitude, and took that information and used it in her own life so that she didn't have to repeat his pattern. We are imprinted by the experiences we have as youngsters in our family of origin. Some research even suggests that we are imprinted while still in the womb. Some pregnant mothers play Beethoven or fill the house with fragrant flowers and the sounds of quiet rain on the roof or music meditations. Who's to say those techniques don't have a beneficial effect? I, too, was imprinted in the womb, but not with the soft sounds of a bubbling brook. I didn't know what exactly I had been imprinted with until well into my adult years. Let me share the backstory. From childhood on, I suffered the dread of impending doom in the form of a certainty that I was soon to be rejected by whomever, for whatever reason. This fear haunted me as a young girl among my girlfriends, and as a teenager trying desperately to attract and keep a boyfriend. Though my exterior looked hard, just like my dad's had looked, my interior was a constant jumble of nerves. My unease, wherever I was, influenced every interaction I had. Of course, I carried this uncertainty into every relationship. I watched my partners like a hawk, certain they were soon to dump me. And dump me they did, of course. My terror about abandonment escalated. It brought tension into a marriage that was troubled by alcohol from the start. My tension, and his too, coupled with our alcoholism, made manifest my worst fear. He abandoned me for another woman. The result was that his action propelled me deeper into my alcoholism, which was fortunately followed by eventual sobriety. It was in early sobriety that I sought the help of a counselor because my fears around abandonment continued to negatively impact my behavior in every romantic relationship and with every friend. The counselor's nearly first words were, You were abandoned in the womb. What allowed her to intuit this, I'll never know. But I didn't doubt, even for a moment, that she was right. However, what to do with this information provided my next stumbling block. Not coincidentally, I was enrolled in a class on the dynamics of the family of origin at the same time. The two experiences, in combination, changed my life in a profound way. The teacher of the family of origin class assigned each one of us to talk to our families, particularly our parents, about their life experiences. The purpose was to see how our experiences mirrored theirs, or perhaps were a reaction to theirs in some significant way. I made the call to my parents, explaining that I wanted to interview them. The silence on the other end of the line was deafening, but they agreed to my request. I went home to talk to them a couple of weeks later, and my life made a right turn. I sat with my mother first, bless her heart. For sure, neither of them wanted to be interrogated. But she did the motherly thing and agreed to go first. "Tell me about your life, Mom." Almost immediately, the tears began to flow and then turned into sobs. "I never felt like a good wife, a good mother, and I didn't want you when I was pregnant with you." Bingo. My counselor had nailed it. My life began to make sense. The abandonment issue that had plagued me my entire life was born in the womb. Having this confirmed at age 38 shed light on my journey, a light that has never been dimmed. When I spoke to my dad, he shared openly the fear he had lived with his entire life, a fear that was shrouded in rage. At the time, it was a new concept for me to see rage as the cover-up for fear. But it made perfect sense. Rage kept people in their place and away from the interior spaces of his being. What an eye-opener my trip home was. My own hard exterior began to develop cracks, and my incessant certainty that every relationship in my life was on a trajectory of inevitable rejection began to ease. With my changed perception about how life was unfolding, I became more willing to trust the process of daily life and to embrace each experience as the next perfect one. This allowed me to truly feel resilient and undaunted. I no longer waited for the bottom to fall out of my world. I no longer waited for everyone else to define my happiness. Being resilient makes it viable to stand tall rather than be knocked down. We can make a decision to stand resilient as every wave of experience hits us. Resilience wears many coats. One of the more brilliant ones is worn by Allison, a fascinating interviewee. She was the first in her very large family to seek help for her addiction. Perhaps I shouldn't say she sought the help. She was institutionalized first, and an insightful counselor could see that her problem wasn't as simple as extreme incorrigibility, but rather alcoholism. The acting out, which included running away and frequent fights in bars, was her cry for help, a cry neither she nor her family recognized initially. Allison's story is long and complicated, and I will cover many parts of it throughout this book, but right now, I want to highlight her resilience. She has a truckload of it. She was the middle child in a family of 8 children. It was easy to get overlooked in a family of that size, particularly when it was troubled by alcoholism, too. Her acting out was probably a way of seeking attention, but it was also the direct result of drinking uncontrollably and doing drugs. For sure, it won her attention, but not the kind she really wanted. Following treatment for the mental problems and the alcoholism, she married. Her life seemed to settle for a time, but her decision to have children meant giving up the medication that stabilized her. Back into the hospital she went, but this time it didn't feel like prison. She found her equilibrium again. She kept going back every time there was a setback. It was as though her lesson in life was to rebound and show the rest of us what resilience looked like.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?